From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. We hear news reports about bombings in mosques, and those bombings spark riots and violent retaliation. Reporters chronicle ongoing conflict between Muslim groups within countries and across borders. Where does all this animosity come from? Writer Leslie Hazelton is a Seattle-based journalist. She's covered the Middle East for a variety of media. Her new book, After the Prophet, explores the roots of the Sunni-Shia split. Leslie Hazelton, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This split, as you describe it, begins with the death of the Prophet Muhammad. It's, in essence, a struggle for power.
It's very much a struggle for power. What happened was that Muhammad died without sons. That is, he had had three sons. Three sons were born, but all three died in infancy. So when he himself died, there was no natural heir, as it were. You know, by the norms of the time and the society, a son would have taken over. And would have taken over a lot, because what Muhammad had done is he had united the tribes of Arabia, and he had united them just at the time that to the north, and then what we now think of as the main part of the Middle East, the Byzantine and Persian empires had fought each other to exhaustion, and there was this huge power vacuum just waiting for a newly united Arabia to sort of surge out north, which it would do. So what was at stake here was not just the leadership of Islam, but also the leadership of a very, very powerful political entity. Now, his closest male relative, who was both his son-in-law and his first cousin, was Ali. And Ali's followers called themselves the Shi'at Ali, which means the followers of Ali, or Shia for short. And they believed that Ali was the one person most qualified to be Muhammad's successor. And successor in Arabic is Khalifa, which we in English know as Caliph. So he should have been the first caliph, according to the Shia. But the Sunnis, who name themselves after the Sunnah, which is the practice of the Prophet, what he did, you know, his daily practice, things he said and so on, things that are sort of outside the Quran, but just as important in many views, or almost as important, let's say, maintained that a power had to be shared, that it had to go to someone from outside Muhammad's immediate family, from his blood family. So there was this very, very basic rift here, basically about who would succeed as both the spiritual and the political successor.
We're talking with Leslie Hazelton about her new book, After the Prophet. And I think for me as a reader, that was one of the things that I found maybe not confusing, but very surprising, mm-hmm. because I have thought of Muhammad solely as a spiritual, mm-hmm. the titular head of a religion. Mm-hmm. And as you describe it, that line between the politics, a person who has been mm-hmm. able to unite many disparate groups mm-hmm. under a single banner, the tightrope between those mm-hmm. two, between faith and politics, seems very tenuous.
In the Middle East, of all places, there is no dividing line between religion and politics. The two are inextricably intertwined. But what happened with Islam, I think, is what happened also with early Judaism and early Christianity. It begins as politics, begins as a political story about who has the power, who controls the territory, and so on. And then it becomes theologized, as it were. It was clear at the time that Muhammad was the spiritual leader. He was the one who had received these amazing revelations, and revelations that united the whole of Arabia because they were in Arabic. It was as though God was speaking to the Arabs, to these people who until then had been sort of to the south of the main action. The main action had always been round about Iraq. And Iraq, of course, is where this story will come into its crystallizing point. It starts in Arabia with Muhammad's death, but very fast, this amazing story of jealousies, of resentments, of hunger for power, of bitter rivalries, will lead to civil war, Muslim against Muslim, in Iraq. Iraq is the cradle of the Shia-Sunni split, and it happened very, very quickly.
One of the key figures, we talked about Ali, the son-in-law, mm-hmm. but the other is one of Muhammad's wives, and Aisha.
Aisha was the youngest and the favorite, as she took great pains to point out many, many times. And we know a lot about Aisha because she is one of the few people in the story who actually would live long enough to write or at least dictate her memoirs, which she did endlessly. Aisha is like a flashpoint. When I hear from Sunnis, in reaction, Sunni readers of this book maintain that I have been far too harsh on Aisha, that I have been disrespectful of her, while Shia readers come back at me and say I've been far too kind to her, I've romanticized her and so on, which I think probably indicates that I got her just right. But in any case, Aisha was always at the forefront of things, always pushing herself to the forefront of things, incredibly outspoken. In fact, she was the first Muslim to hurl a shoe in protest at a caliph whom she considered corrupt, and probably was incredibly corrupt. And it was Aisha who would, just 25 years after Muhammad's death, lead an army of 10,000 men into battle against Ali, a woman. A Muslim woman leading an army into battle. The battle was called the Battle of the Camel for good reason. At the very center of it was Aisha, seated on her red camel, hurling these blood-curdling cries and so on, urging her men on to greater feats of valor and gore and slaughter, even as the battle, her side began to lose the battle, she could see her own men being cut down literally at her feet, and she just refused to concede.
Was the relationship she had with Ali, because of course they knew each other, was it one of jealousy? Was she jealous of his relationship with Muhammad? Was she jealous of his power?
So. Yeah, I think so. This is one of the things that amazes Westerners. Everybody knew each other in the story. Everybody was related one way or the other. In fact, everybody was related to everybody else at least three or four different ways.
Right.
The whole idea of family in 7th century Arabia, in fact, in the Middle East today in general, just beggars the Western idea of the nuclear family, which is nothing, you know. You cannot even make a family tree out of what was happening there. It's more like this vast jungle of vines which sort of intertwining and each one coming back on the other and spreading out. You'd need a hologram to define it all.
And this is all in 7th century AD, correct?
This is 7th century, yes.
And as you're talking about this right now, I guess when one thinks of a spiritual leader, you think of, or at least in this country, we think of the Christian, the Jewish and Christian Bibles, which are far earlier. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you base this on histories that were written not long after all this happened.
That's why it's so vivid in my mind. This is why it's so vivid in the minds of people in the Middle East. What we're talking about here, this whole story is recognized throughout the Middle East by all Muslims, Sunni and Shia, as history. Except for the Shia, it is also sacred history.
Our guest this hour, Seattle-based writer Leslie Hazelton, who has covered the Middle East for many years, and her new book is called After the Prophet, The Epic Story of the Shia-Sunni Split in Islam. And you talk about the bloody split, and there's a word that I won't pronounce right, fitna.
Fitna, yes.
Which is really kind of at the heart, and this is sort of civil war between one people.
It's a very, very, very sensitive word in Islam. Fitna means discord, dissension, and usually civil war, but it always implies chaos and upheaval. And in fact, before the Battle of the Camel, people on both sides were arguing passionately against civil war. This was the first time that Muslim killed Muslim. And you can sense, I mean, it's very, very clear, the fear of it, the desperate need to avoid civil war, even as they knew, all of them, that it was all but inevitable. One guy said, you know, this is a rift that will never be repaired. We cannot go here. And it's an evil wind. Or another says, if we do this, the millstone of Islam will be out of balance and there'll never be any righting it, and so on. And you can sense you've got two huge armies, 10,000 men each side, and the leaders in the middle negotiating, desperate to find a way not to fight each other. And finally, after 3 days, they did agree. They agreed to disagree. It was huge relief on both sides, except for one small group. And nobody even then knew exactly who they were, whether it was a group of hotheads, whether it was a group of extreme radicals or what, who wanted war. Dawn the next morning, they started fighting, and within moments, I mean, you've got 10,000 men fully armed on each side, you just hear the sound of fighting. Within moments, the whole battlefield was engaged. So that first civil war was so nearly avoided, and yet, as I say, everybody kind of knew that it was inevitable. And you get the sense very much today, this whole story is referred to, is brought up, images from it, scenes of it, iconic images from it are used all the time today. They have been through the centuries. In fact, this is a story that is so alive. You know, in the Middle East, memories are very, very long. And what happened, say, in the year 680 AD with the massacre of Muhammad's grandson, Hussein, at Karbala, is as alive in the minds of Shia today as if it had happened just yesterday.
Now, Hussein really is a focal point because maybe you want to talk a little bit about him. We're sort of skipping ahead 50 years. What happened was that there was an agreement to select a successor to Muhammad, and Ali, as you portray him, stepped back and waited his turn, which didn't come for a while.
For the sake of unity, and unity is a word that comes up again and again. On the one hand, unity; on the other hand, fitna, discord, dissension. Unity was what Muhammad had done. He'd unified the Arab tribes. He'd made them into a power. And a power that then took over the whole of the Middle East. I mean, you had a vast empire at stake here. Disunity meant weakening the empire, which is why today, for instance, there's a widespread suspicion throughout the Middle East that fitna, civil war in Iraq, has been deliberately fostered by the West in order to weaken Islam. I think it's quite clear that this gives Western policymakers credit for far more understanding than they've ever displayed about the Shia-Sunni split. But it seems incredible to people in the Middle East that Westerners should know so little about this history, which to them is such an essential part of their identity, especially for the Shia, who commemorate it every year in the 10 days of Ashura, which commemorates the massacre at Karbala.
Now, Hussein, Muhammad's grandson, the son of Ali, eventually came to the forefront after a number of of leaders who were, as you portray them, in various stages of either power hungry, wanting to do well, or maybe ignoring what was written on the wall in terms of the discord in the unity. So talk a little bit about Hussein and the situation he found himself in.
Well, Ali, first of all, his father Ali was assassinated. He ruled for 5 years, not as the first caliph, but as the fourth caliph. He was assassinated by radical extremists from his own side. And when that happened, this wonderful character, I mean, to me, absolutely fascinating character, an incredibly wily, savvy, and crafty politician called Muawiyah, a name that's unknown in the West, though I have no idea why, because without him, the Arab Empire, the Islamic Empire, would never have survived. It would have devolved into all-out civil war. Muawiyah took over as caliph and imposed, by force and by wile, let's say a pragmatic kind of peace, right, or a pragmatic kind of unity. But his son, he formed the first Sunni dynasty. When his son took over, his son was not nearly as wise as he was. And the Iraqis called on Hussein, who then was in Medina, to come and save them, to come. They would rise up against this corrupt caliph in Damascus under his leadership. So he set out from Medina with just 72 warriors and all his family, in the belief that the Iraqis would indeed rise up under him, this massive force, and would overthrow the caliph in Damascus, and the caliphate would be back where it belonged, in the family, the blood family of Muhammad, known as Al-Bayt, the people of the house of Muhammad. In fact, the Iraqis did not rise up under him. When you have a really, really corrupt and vicious leader, as there was at the time, any kind of sign of rebellion is put down quite ruthlessly, as it was. And what happened is that Hussein basically led his 72 warriors and his family into this terrible trap, which resulted in this massacre. This was the last of the five leading members, the five people closest of all to Muhammad. The whole of the Muslim world at the time was in shock, whether they were Sunni or Shia. How could this happen? How could it have come to this, where the favorite grandson of the Prophet himself is not only killed, but his body trampled into the dust of Karbala, his head cut off and speared on the point of a spear and then taken in procession and mistreated and so on and so on. The women in chains, the children in chains and so on. Just immense shock, which still reverberates throughout the Muslim world, that this could even happen.
Leslie Hazelton is the author of After the Fall, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. How much did the American administration understand about really the cultural landscape, the historic landscape, before diving into a war in the Middle East?
I'm not sure whether to laugh or cry in response. So little, it is absolutely dismaying. Totally dismaying. The very idea of sort of, okay, we're going to go liberate the Shia, you know, from the Sunni. I mean, it's just such a misunderstanding of, such a total lack of understanding, in fact. You know, it was also as though somebody had told them, okay, there's these people called Shia and there's these people called Sunni and they don't like each other and you can go in and play them off one against the other without knowing anything at all of what was really behind all this. This is beginning to change. You have people talking about the need for cultural communication and cultural understanding. But even then, I'm not sure they realize how deep they need to go. The story demands to be told in full with all the passion and all the vividness with which it was first written and with which it is known inside the Middle East. And if we cannot grasp it as people in the Middle East do, we are, I would say, doomed to failure there.
It sounds as if that when the initial entry in 2003 was made, there was this idea, oppressed Shia by Sunni minority, and then we were going to liberate. Our entry, besides being violent and being a war, what does the presence of the West mean for the relationships between Sunni and Shia? What role do we play?
You don't even actually have to go back 1,400 years. You can go back just 100 years. You can go back to 1916 when the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed, in which the British and the French had divided up the old Ottoman Empire between them. You can go back to 1953 when the CIA and the Brits overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh in Iran and reimposed the Shah, and when the CIA and America openly supported the incredibly authoritarian regime of the Shah. You can go back to the fact that we were in the 1980s. The United States was arming both sides in the Iran-Iraq war. So by the time 2003 happened, it was just like a continuation of the same.
Do you think that the current administration is any different in its attempts to understand than the administration that brought us into that region?
I'm seeing signs, or rather I'm hearing signs. I'm not sure how deep it goes yet. I'm not seeing an acknowledgement of how deep we really need to go and how far we need to go in order to achieve that. But there are signs of a different approach of working with people who actually live there instead of for them, as though we know better. But we have a long, long way to go. And as I say, just knowing what's behind it, knowing the history, knowing the power of this history to inspire people today seems to me essential. I don't see how we can expect to achieve anything at all in the Middle East without knowing the story.
Leslie Hazelton's book, Story of the Shia-Sunni Split in Islam, is called After the Prophet. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is KUOW 94.9 FM, Seattle.